You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Grant Rogers, and in this episode I'm talking to Pat Mills about writing Charlie's War, his extraordinary comic book about the First World War.
Hello, Pat. My name's Grant Rogers. I'm one of the education officers at the Imperial War Museum.
Excellent.
Okay, and I've been looking forward to speaking to you probably since about 1976. I think one of the reasons I have to say that I'm probably doing the work that I'm doing now is as a result of Charlie's War.
Really?
Yeah, well, I'm an artist who's sort of like washed up on these shores, and I did a graphics degree at Portsmouth, and one of the things that got me drawing was actually looking at Charlie's War, and I got really interested in it then, really interested.
Excellent.
Yeah, so that's the sort of the pagan idolatry out of the way. What I'd like to talk to you about today, and I think Alex's idea between about me talking to you, was to come at this from a museum's viewpoint, a museum that has a very extensive collection of World War I memorabilia.
Okay.
And also, I think one of the questions that we'll come back to in a little while, but just to pose it, how we as a nation choose to remember conflict and choose to interpret conflict and our presented conflict. So it's quite a big area of discussion. But to start off with, I was wondering if you could just start talking to us a little bit, speak us through why Charlie's War. Well, let's just start with that. How you started with the idea of Charlie's War, please.
Okay. Well, I suppose it started in a kind of almost accidental way. I wanted to do a story with a difference, and I was working on a war comic which I had helped create, namely Battle, and nobody had ever done a World War I story, so there was a challenge to that. How do you do a World War I story? Because that was always the problem. It's very static, there's no movement, and it would be generally, I think, conjectured that a World War I story is going to crash. It's going to go down like a lead balloon because it's static. You cannot glorify war like any other war. World War II, you can have lots of excitement, lots of drama, and you don't have to get too serious.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, I like the challenge of it. And I had been very, very influenced by Oh, What a Lovely War, which is a fantastic film. And it really was my Sound of Music. As a teenager, I think I must have seen it at least, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 times. I mean, just totally riveted by it. Although I should say, in recent years, and this does have some relevance to our discussion, I've seen a comment by, several comments by a Sandhurst historian along the lines that, this was all kind of 70s, kind of Vietnam-influenced anti-war sentiment, which is absolute nonsense, because if you look at the cast of Oh, What a Lovely War, you can see that there are, most of the distinguished actors in British cinema.
Yeah, absolutely.
Featured in it. And anyway, so that was my background, and I started to research World War I, and I thought, oh my God, I can't do this. How on earth do I make this work? And eventually I reached a painful decision, which was, I'm actually going to have to write this really well. I'm not going to write this like most comic stories. I have to write this really well, with a great deal of depth. It's going to drive me crazy, but I have to do it this way. And even apart from the fact that I Oh, What a Lovely War was a sort of major influence on me, even that aside, I knew that the only way you could write this was in an anti-war way. So there was a sense of dread there, really. How am I going to make this work? I'd agreed to do it, and so that was the first aspect.
Can I just interrupt just for one moment? What I'm getting, and I felt when I first saw Oh, What a Lovely War, that it was it really was a genuinely anti-war film.
Yes.
Rather than, isn't war terrible?
And, absolutely.
Yeah, and I feel that when I've just reread Charlie's War, you know, it's horrific, Pat. It's absolutely horrific. And I don't know whether it's my advancing years.
So, and I think it's interesting what you said there. There is a criteria for a genuine anti-war film or a genuine anti-war comic, which is if it, you know, if it really puts you off the idea of war, then it has achieved its objective. Now, the thing is, in comics and in cinema, there are many, many stories which claim to be anti-war, but are actually having their cake and eat it. Now,
yeah.
the danger of those kind of films, I think, I mean, some of them are excellent films, but they do try and have it both ways,
mm-hmm.
is that if you consider, I think, certainly before the first Gulf War, and possibly after the second, young American soldiers were watching, I think it was Apocalypse Now
and
similar kind of films,
yeah.
to psych themselves up before they went into action. That is the danger of these kind of war is hell, but we've got to do it, this kind of post-John Wayne kind of film.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I do remember the scene in Jarhead. When they're sitting around watching
yes.
Apocalypse Now, and they're all singing along with the Wagner. I know exactly what you mean by that.
It is very disturbing. So it has to be genuine. At the same time, it doesn't have to be a dirge. I mean, any area of human endeavour is exciting, dramatic, funny, sad, and involves conflict. So it doesn't have to be depressing in a total kind of way. And of course, there's nothing magical about this. All one has to do is to go back to the original records, the original anecdotes, the poems, the songs, and once you start reading them, you realise they're separated from us by several generations. But they are so much like us. You know, you can feel that kind of Monty Python comedy, that British cynicism that's very unique to us. And that's what's so wonderful about, I think, that aspect of the conflict. The stories of these ordinary soldiers, the way they kind of criticised authority, in a way that we still do today.
Okay, yeah, I mean, the genius of Python and the genius of something like Blackadder is the quality of the research which has gone into it.
Exactly.
They are very, very clever people making us laugh at something which is actually quite horrific. And there's
yes.
no denying that there is genuine humour in Charlie's War too.
That is true. And this brings me on to the artist, because I mean, nowadays there are some very talented artists who could probably make something like that work. But in those days, there weren't that many, what shall I call them, face artists. An artist who can convey facial expressions. Now, for me, Joe Cahoon, the artist, really is numero uno for me. And it's a disappointment for me that although Charlie's War is very highly regarded by what I would call mainstream readers, Joe's contribution to British comic art has not fully been acknowledged by fandom. In other words, they've still got this emphasis on fantasy and science fiction. Now, really, for me, Joe Cahoon is up there with Frank Hansen, the creator of Dan Dare, and so forth. And the particular reason he is up there is his gift for faces. I mean, every one of those characters in Charlie's War, their faces move, they smile, they're sad. Every character is an individual. It's beautifully crafted.
Pat, one of the things that I remember really very, very strongly is literally the face of the sergeant, Old Bill. And Joe had a way of drawing a circular illustration box which just had a facial expression. And I do remember one episode finishing with them charging across no man's land and the wild-eyed sort of terror and adrenaline at the same time that he manages to convey in that is absolutely astonishing. Now, was Joe the first choice of artist for... Was it just like a natural, that's who you wanted?
Yes, he was the choice. He was the first choice because Joe had already done something quite remarkable and quite fantastic, which was... I mean, Battle was a comic that was a transition comic from the old regime of, you know, very typical war images, to what you might call a new wave of British comics. And there was a story in there called Johnny Red, which compromised in as much as it had that rather old-fashioned device of a British pilot fighting with the Russians, but reasonable enough, I think. But what it did show, and this was an incredible achievement of the writer Tom Tully and the artist Joe Cahoon, was the suffering of the people of Leningrad during 1941-1942, and the images in there were absolutely astonishing. And these were not images really that I think the artist could have got from photographic references. Joe always claimed he used photographic references, but frankly I think a lot of it came from his soul, and I really mean that, not from his head, from his soul. There was a kind of gift to him, the way he portrayed them, that really has no other explanation. So he was a natural artist, and it was an extraordinary thing for the editor to do, who was really the, for me, is a real superstar of this whole strip, because he did something that I believe has never happened before, and certainly has never happened since, where he took an artist on a top-running story like Johnny Red, which was incredibly popular, and he took him off that story and put him on an unknown story about World War I. Johnny Red then carried on with a second artist and was popular enough but lost its ascendancy. Now, yeah. This is a very, very daring thing to do. It'd be like Frank Hampson being on Dan Dare and being taken off to work on something entirely different. It's a very dangerous thing to do. And I think it's one of the reasons why I worked so hard on the story, because I was so gratified and so thankful that the editor had such confidence in the concept.
So the story starts with Charlie joining up. He's underaged, I believe, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Why was it important for him to be underage? It's a very specific sort of place to start with this individual.
The story had to... I mean, every story, I think, every conflict has an iconic character to it. And I think for World War One, it had to be the Somme. It had to be a soldier on the Somme. And it had to be a soldier who joined up underage, as so many of them did. And also somebody who wasn't... Who was patriotic, you know, who really believed, who was not cynical in any possible way, and who wasn't especially intelligent either.
Yeah.
A very normal kid, really. And again, I mean, this really broke all the conventional rules of comics, which invariably had, you know, very macho heroes, you know, people with death wishes, strange helmets, and so forth.
Of course.
But at the same time, I think everyone, the editor, the readers, the artists realize that is an iconic image of World War One. I mean, when we think of the soldiers in the trenches, invariably we are likely to think of the ones who volunteered, who were kids, and who were very, very ordinary people.
And you establish a layer which I was really taken with. I was very familiar with Charlie's family at home in the East End of London. And
yes.
You used a device to keep them very much part of the narrative, which was the letter writing between Charlie and his parents or sister. Could you just talk us through a little bit as to why you wanted to use that idea?
I have seen the letter writing device used once before in a story about the Crimean War. It was letters home from a nurse. And I thought it was very effective. It was a great device for getting into things. And also, I wanted to use the postcards of World War One, because my father-in-law was a collector of postcards, so he had some of the classic ones of World War One, including the all-time favourite, the Bruce Bairnsfather cartoon of two soldiers in a shell hole, yeah. And one's looking very fed up, and the other one, who's old Bill, looks at him and says, "Well, if you knows of a better role, go to it." And that is so archetypally British. So I wanted to use those postcards, which captured the whole feeling of World War One. So they are intercut with the letters. Unfortunately, I couldn't sustain it beyond, I think, about the first 6 months of the series, if that. And so eventually the letters home had to stop, because they would have appeared repetitive, trite, or a bit manipulated if I had continued with them.
One of the things that I'm recalling now is when somebody comments to Charlie that he's actually stopped writing letters home, and he says, "I wouldn't know what to put. I wouldn't know what to say. How do I describe this?"
And that's fair, isn't it, really?
Because I think
he, at a certain point, all his bonhomie, all his sense of, this is all a bit of an adventure and everything, and all his sense of still having his family with him, that would all go, and he would realise he was in an alien world.
Can you talk us through a little bit some of the other characters? Because it's not just Charlie, it's Ginger, it's Sarge, it's Oily. They've all stayed with me.
That's tremendous. And as I say, a lot of that is down to Joe in particular, because of the way that he defined them all in minute detail. I think one of my favourites is Smith 70.
The machine gun operator, yeah.
Is one of those kind of... It was the way that Joe drew him. Joe drew him as this kind of eccentric sort of character, and I just sort of responded to that. It's something that I don't often get the chance to do so much these days. If an artist draws a character in a very unusual way or a very interesting way, then I really want to write about him, and that, of course, is why characters like Smith 70... Have stayed with us, and his name, of course, is fascinating. There were so many Smiths in every regiment, so in fact it would have been 70 Smith, but it sounded better Smith 70. And I think my particular incident with him that I found fascinating was an account in Robert Graves, Goodbye to All That, where the British used to fire off machine gun bullets to heat up the water in the
to make a brew,
cooling device, and then they would make tea. So in other words, they're firing off all these bullets, and it's putting the kettle on. And Robert Graves makes the point that this is all very well, but it's going to put money on income tax after the war. Now, that was also challenged, actually, by this Sandhurst historian who said, this is one of these, apocryphal stories that isn't true. And I checked, double-checked, and treble-checked, and I'm pretty certain it's true. And let's be honest, that's exactly what Brits would do, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you checked and you checked and you checked. Now, how often did you find yourself in the Imperial War Museum doing your research here?
I came to the Imperial War Museum at the very beginning of doing Charlie's War, and it's probably not there now, but you may know of it, but just down the road from the Imperial War Museum was a shop which sold for peanuts, actually. I wish I still had them. Original copies of World War One magazines and newspapers. It was just down the road from you, literally a few minutes' walk. And I remember buying a stack of these and using the content wherever I could in stories. And, of course, I spent a full day in the Imperial War Museum looking around and seeing all these incredible, truly strange and medieval artifacts that were used as weaponry in World War One.
The trench clubs, for instance, the whole notion of, hammering some nails into a stick to use on someone else's head.
That's right. And, in fact, when I used some of these featured some of these weapons in Charlie's War, there were people who would write in and challenge us and say, this is a typical comic story. You're making it up. Why can't you write serious comic stories?
Yep.
The idea that the snipers went round with metal masks that they thought was ridiculous. That having these peculiar weapons they thought was silly. I think one particular reader wrote in to complain about dogs wearing gas masks.
Yeah.
He thought the idea was so idiotic. And this, of course, just emphasizes something that is I feel very strongly about, that World War One, I mean, all wars are nightmarish and science fiction in one sense, but I think the Great War was, in a way, the first science fiction war. And because it's in the past, we tend to ignore that. But it really was a science fiction war in the sense that what was appearing there was so unfamiliar, so ghastly, so grotesque, that it sort of comes under that category. The images are totally bizarre.
Mm.
And I think... I've always, another thing I also feel is that it's a great shame that the kind of criteria Joe and I established in Charlie's War has never really been picked up on since, so that we can look at other wars in that way.
Well, I cannot think of, I'm not the most widely read of graphic novels or comic strips. I'm somebody who enjoys Lone Wolf and Cub, or I've really enjoyed Bone, or I've got my favourites, and
sure.
I've had to do the reading for the museum as well, so I've had to read Beth Again and Mouse and sort of works like that, and I do go back to them, I do pick them up, but I cannot think of anything that has, given the way that this was published, think of the audience.
Yes.
Anything like this, it's out there on its own. There have been no imitators, have there?
That's exactly it. And in a way, I'm kind of slightly sad about that, because I think with any comic book, if it's popular, the first thing that other writers or other artists will do is think, okay, let's do something like that. Judge Dredd comes along, so you have other characters, get in that style. But this never happened with Charlie's War, and I think the prime reason is it's very difficult to do. There is one exception now. It's only got to issue 2. Interestingly enough, it's I think it's by a writer called Steve Beeny from Nazca Studios, and it's about about British soldiers fighting in Iraq in the 1920s, and the first use of poison gas by at the orders of Winston Churchill, the entrance of Bomber Harris on the scene, and he sent me copies of this, and I do always make a point of saying that this is the natural successor to Charlie's War. In fact, when I came to the end of Charlie's War in 1919, where he returns home from Russia, I did seriously think about having him go to Iraq. Now, this was back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I researched, and I couldn't find anything that would justify doing it. I didn't have enough material. And this guy has gone out, and he's written it in the same style as Charlie's War. He's a new, young artist, so it's not like Joe Cahoon's work, but he's heavily influenced by Joe, and he's definitely getting there.
I'm thrilled to hear that somebody's tackling something like Iraq, because it's a conflict which is still very much underway. So
a lot of people are very reticent about putting their sort of head on the block and sort of saying it's like this, it's like that, it's like the other, because we can get shot down. Major Thompson, or Captain Thompson, I think, was the first soldier to be killed in Iraq after, I think it was in 1920, just north of Baghdad, and I think he was killed by a roadside device. And it's the old story of insurgents coming out of Syria, operating under the authorship or the sort of control of a radical Shiite sort of imam. It sounds very, very familiar.
And when I read it, I think that's how I would have written it. In other words, I'd have had Charlie go out to Iraq. You know, he shows the scenes of the British dropping poison gas on the Kurds.
Yeah.
And so forth. But that wasn't to be, and so...
That brings several points together, actually, very neatly, is the concept of a good war in the public consciousness, and also something which is a good weapon. You're talking about science fiction and modernism coming to play. One of the images I really remember is of the German soldiers cowering in the trenches, holding up their gospels as this tank plunges down on them. It's as if they're trying to hold this evil creature back. And yet the public in this country see the tank as almost a cozy icon, in the same way as we'd look at the Spitfire with some nostalgia. Or, you know, in modern parlance, you know, people get very excited by Kalashnikovs. It's become a design icon. I was really interested how you chose to use these, as these are evil weapons, and this comes through very strongly.
That is very well observed. We do become conditioned to these things. I mean, if one thinks, for example, of a modern American tank, I think it's an Abraham tank.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way it's presented to us, we think of it as something, impressive, like something out of Star Wars. It's not. It's a hideous weapon, extremely lethal. It uses depleted uranium, and despite its awesome qualities, it actually uses up a hell of a lot of fuel. Its carbon footprint doesn't bear thinking about. So I wanted to feature the original World War One tanks in a similar way, to show them as not, I think the way they're generally presented today, World War One tanks, is as something rather comical, or, well, they're not real tanks, you know, let's get on to the Panzers of World War Two. You know, everything becomes rather glossed over and romanticized. What a hellish device it was to be inside, where you're wearing a chainmail mask, like a medieval warrior.
Yeah, and also you described the wild eye that comes to tank crews when they've been inside and exposed to the fumes for a long time.
Yeah, that's another thing that's absolutely extraordinary, that the noise, the lack of ventilation, I mean, these really must have been quite hellish things to be inside. What's remarkable is, if you look at the images that Joe has drawn, they've come out of his head, but again, I say they've come out of his soul, because it looks like he was there. And you think, how could he possibly know what the inside of a tank would look like? Because if you look at lesser artists' work, they just fudge it. They just be shadow. But, you know, you look and you think, my God, that's actually what it was like. Another artist said to me once that Joe had a gift where if he looked at a picture from one angle, let's say a house, a tank, anything, he could imagine what it looked like from other angles. And that is not verging on the psychic, but it is an extraordinary gift to be able to visualize the rest from a little piece of information.
One of the things that I think is very brave about Charlie's War is just how graphic some of the images are. There's a particular set of drawings, a particular passage, which is the death of Ginger.
Yes, that was inspired by a sequence I read in a book called Eye Deep in Hell. And I should say at the very beginning that I always made sure that every incident in Charlie's War either could definitely have happened or was based very closely on an incident I had read, because it would have been gratuitous to have done anything different and disrespectful, I think. So this particular incident, Ginger is blown up at the end of an episode, which was quite shocking for the readers and very deliberate on my part, because normally, and you can always see it in a modern movie, when someone's going to die, you can feel the scriptwriter sharpening his pen. And you're thinking, oh, we're building him up. He said goodbye to his girlfriend. You know, he's sorted out his problems with his dad, etc. and that's rubbish, because death doesn't work like that, yeah. Particularly in war. And so Ginger's just behaving absolutely normally. He's a bit of a jerk. And then suddenly, bang, he's dead. And that's all over. And that shocked the readers, because they were used to this, you know, heavily signposted approach to fiction. He's blown up at the end of an episode.
Yeah, yes. And the drawings that I remember, Joe's drawings I remember, is Charlie just staggering down the trench in the rain. It's a very sort of silent, it's a very sort of thoughtful moment. The look of shock on Charlie's face, and he's carrying his friends or his friends' remains
in
looks like a sandbag.
That's right. And an officer confronts him, and he thinks, because he's walking away from the front line, that he has, you know, he's stolen something. And he says, "What have you got in that bag,
yeah.
soldier?"
Yeah.
And he stares towards us, and he says, "My mate, sir, my mate Ginger." And that, as I say, was inspired by an incident I read in Eye Deep in Hell, because it would have been inappropriate to make anything like that up. It had to be true. And it's a way of, what should we say, recording those events so that anyone who reads Charlie's War, there, of course, it's still a work of fiction, but you can think, this is really what it was like for that generation. And I think it is very important to record it, as you do in the Imperial War Museum. And I my particular thing was to really bring across the, what you might call the working class aspect, who just slightly sometimes, I think it, when I look at, it's been a while since I've looked at the national curriculum, so I'm probably going to be corrected here, but certainly in the past, I've looked at various curriculums on World War One, and there is this emphasis on the middle class poets and so forth, and I wanted to kind of put a counterbalance to that, if you like, to show more of a holistic view of World War One.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that at GCSE, I can't speak for A-level, but at GCSE, they are very much on first-hand evidence of the ordinary soldier, the working class experience, for want of a better word. And this is something which is very strong. I get the sense from Charlie's War that this is being written as a class war. There are very few officers that you are sympathetic to. I remember, I can't remember his name, is it? There's one officer who's Charlie.
Lieutenant Thomas.
That's the man, yeah. Can you talk us a little bit through that?
Yes, I can. I think, I mean, with any war, there is a sense of cannon fodder, and there is a sense of, you know, profiteering, and I think World War One certainly made a lot of money for Krupp and all the other arms manufacturers, and I couldn't approach that directly, because how could Charlie know about any of this stuff? But it is hinted at here and there, and I think the other thing is that I think World War One is very interesting on another level, that the class division is there very obviously. I mean, there were, for example, there were dugouts. They never used this in Blackadder, and at least I don't think they did, and I wish they had. A servant's bell. In other words, the officer rings a bell, and his butler comes along. And this sort of thing actually did happen. In other words, they carried on their old class traditions into the trenches.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert on World War II, but I suspect that some of those things were still there, but they were, I think they were much more self-conscious about how it could be open for criticism, because in the interwar years, by the sound of things, there was enormous criticism of what had happened. There was a very strong anti-war feeling. There was certainly a strong mutiny. Towards the end of World War One, there were riots in 1919, and whatever the reality, certainly there was a genuine fear of revolution in 1919.
Yeah.
So I think by the time it got to World War Two, my feeling is that they toned down some of the more obvious aspects of the class struggle, and you know the conflict, that kind of endemic thing in British society.
There is very much a sea change in British society, whereas we're presented with World War One as the history of empire, whereas World War Two is very much the citizens' war. The whole nation at war. We're camouflaging our pets, basically, aren't we?
Yes.
And it's that whole thing of we're all in this together. Though there's a very clear distinction between the front and the home front in World War One.
Although the Zeppelins...
The terror raids,
they were still seen as terror weapons in World War One. I mean, the effect on the civilian population by World War Two standards... does seem quite slight, but I think at the time people were really terrified. There were they forced their way into the underground. The underground was not open to be used as shelters, and then you had these giant bombers that followed the Zeppelins. Couldn't really feature very strongly, called the Gothers, and these once again were like something out of science fiction.
And we're going to have to sort of round this up, I think. Pat, I could go on talking for hours, so maybe we could do this again and sort of like pick out some threads. But there's one aspect of it that you touched on there which I'm particularly interested in. It's big business making profit out of conflict.
Yes.
Obviously, if the gross product of Iraq was asparagus, we wouldn't be there now.
Totally.
If you could get... it's this, how many millionaires did World War One actually create? Do you know?
I do have some information on that. There was a United States colonel, and if you gave me a second, I could get his name, who spilled the beans, and he wrote a book about it in the 1920s. And this actually goes into how many arms dealers made profits, primarily American, but I think some of it applies to Britain as well.
Yeah.
And he really spilled the beans on the whole thing. And he was a very important American Marine general, I believe. And he was not a left-winger, you know, so in other words, it's very inconvenient what he was saying, because he was actually one of those guys who was... sort of attacking the unemployed in their shanty towns. He was no radical, but he spilled the beans and he really spelt it out. And it's a book that's often picked up by people in the peace movement, but its inconvenient truths are generally ignored elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure that some of our listeners may be aware that the company who supplied the Imperial German Army with its cement in 1913. To line, it's the very cement which is used in the trenches complex around Beaumont Hamel, was a British company.
And that's true. That is very true. And I knew that when I was writing Charlie's War, and I think I may, but I can't swear to this, I think I may have had somebody whose father was an arms dealer, and in the trenches, I may have had that. So I tried to find a way to slip it in, but occasionally I would force the pace, and I really had to watch myself that I didn't get too polemic. But it's interesting what you're saying, and I think I would add one more thought to that, which is there's a well-known book about World War II called Trading with the Enemy, which talks about Ford's role in World War II.
Coca-Cola as well.
And Standard Oil and so forth. Now, my feeling is that this very accepted and authentic book about World War II is showing major involvement of transnationals, really, supplying both sides. Now, if that's true for World War II, it really doesn't bear thinking about actually what was going on in World War I. My own feeling is it went a lot further than just cement.
I think you're absolutely right. Pat, it's been a pleasure to finally talk to you. I've been waiting for 20 years to do it, and hopefully we'll get to talk again.
I hope so too. Okay then, thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to know more about this podcast and download previous editions, please go to www.panelborders.com and click on the link marked blog. Thanks for listening.